Woe to the city, guilty of bloodshed. She is full of lies. She is filled with plunder. She has hoarded her spoil. The chariot drivers will crack their whips. The chariot wheels will shake the ground. The chariot horses will gallop. The war chariots will bolt forward. The charioteers will charge ahead. Their swords will flash and their spears will glimmer. There will be many people slain. There will be piles of the dead and countless casualties. So many that people will stumble over the corpses. Thus we find Nahum chapter 3 verses 1 through 3 as part of what we find in Nahum 1 and verse 1 as the oracle about Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum the Elkoshite. Nahum is prophesying in Judah sometime between 663 and 612 BC, and Nineveh is the most prominent city of the Assyrians. It is a global metropolis of the 7th century BC, and also represents, of course, the greatness of Assyrian power, which is dominant at this time. Assyria had ended the kingdom of Israel and exiled its inhabitants and devastated and oppressed Judah until the since the time of around 750 until the days of Nahum himself. Nahum would sing a song in chapter 1, verses 2 through 10, praising God as zealous and avenging. And he prophesied the defeat and downfall of Nineveh, and that this good news he proclaimed in Judah in chapter 1, verses 11 through 15. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, Nahum envisioned the scenes of the siege of Nineveh, its fall, and its immediate after effects, and has most recently been taunting Nineveh and Assyria, asking what happened to this den of lions. Nahum 3 and verse 1 begins with woe, and in fact, Nahum 3, 1 through 7 is a woe oracle against Nineveh. A woe oracle is a projecting judgment and devastation against whomever they are their objects. It is a source of bitterness and lamentation for those against whom that woe is decreed. And so in these first three verses, Nahum is describing the scenario, the city in its present form, that it's guilty of bloodshed, full of lies, filled with plunder and hoarded spoil. And then the experience of warfare within it, with the chariot drivers going back and forth. In chapter 2, we noted that the chariot drivers were most likely the Assyrians themselves within Nineveh. At this point, it could still have some reference to them, but is probably more likely their Median and Babylonian enemies because of all the people slain. The idea of the city is guilty of bloodshed is a reference of blood guilt. Blood guilt is an incredibly serious matter in ancient Israel. It is most often associated with the ground on which blood was shed. So if you look in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 1 through 9, just to give an idea of how important matters of bloodshed and blood guilt were, it said that if there's just a dead body in a field somewhere, somebody has met with foul play and is in a field, the two closest towns or villages need to kind of measure out and figure out who is closer to where that body was found. And whichever village was closest to it needs to offer sacrifice in which they declare, we don't know who did this, but we are offering the sacrifice to expiate the blood guilt that's on the ground. Because if they don't, that blood guilt will remain and it will cost them somebody's blood. So it's very serious. And so when that's the level of blood guilt that can be concerned about, that even if everybody knows nobody did it in the area, but that blood guilt's still there, how much more then for the Assyrians who had slaughtered how many untold thousands throughout the ancient Near Eastern world over the past few hundred years? And likewise, Nineveh would be incredibly wealthy because of all those military exploits that led to the blood guilt over the previous 200 years. And the description that Nahum gives, of course, is extremely visceral and revolting of the corpses piled up to the point where you are going to stumble over them. You can't just walk on the streets because there's too many dead bodies around. Very terrible, but not inaccurate in what would end up happening. Nahum continues, because you have acted like a wanton prostitute, a seductive mistress who practices sorcery, who enslaves nations by her harlotry and entices people by her sorcery, I am against you, declares Yahweh of heaven's armies. I will strip off your clothes. I will show your nakedness to the nations and your shame to the kingdoms. I will pelt you with filth. I will treat you with contempt. I will make you a public spectacle. Everyone who sees you will turn away from you in disgust. They will say, Nineveh has been devastated. Who will lament for her? There will be no one to comfort you. This is the second half of what we said with the wool oracle in verses 4 through 7, and it's describing Nineveh in terms of a prostitute. While Visitation of Prostitutes by Johns is likely not strongly censured or shamed in the ancient world, the work of prostitution itself was recognized as degrading and shameful, and they were delegitimized just by virtue of their profession. In Israel already, the metaphor of idolatry as prostitution had developed in the prophetic tradition. But, as we can see, for instance, in Hosea, it's very much focused on Israel acting as the prostitute. And there's a reason for that. Yahweh and the prophets go with that shameful metaphor to try to shake Israel out of its complacency in their religious syncretism and serving all these different gods, to recognize that what they were doing was quite severe. That serving the gods of the nations meant dishonoring Yahweh, just like if their wives went out and prostituted themselves to others, would be a great shame to them and to their husbands. So that logic makes sense and is understandable in terms of how Israel can be the prostitute. But here now, in terms of Nineveh, that core concept of a people or a city as a prostitute, city here specifically, is maintained but taken in a very different direction. Because it doesn't make sense to condemn Nineveh and the Assyrians for disloyalty to Yahweh, because they were never called to loyalty to Yahweh in the first place. They're the Assyrians, they're not Israel. Now we have to remember, cities are almost always encoded as female. This is something that happens grammatically, that normally you will use more feminine grammatical terms for cities, and also in our anthropomorphization. So when we look at a city, we normally talk about a city in terms of her. So for instance, daughter Zion in 2 Kings 19:21 would be an example of this as well in Scripture. Now, to consider the full force of the prostitution imagery, we should stop to think, how would Nineveh have considered itself? How would the Assyrians have recognized Nineveh? They would want to portray Nineveh in their propaganda as a queenly city, right? As one that's legitimate and honorable in its wealth and its power. So to speak of Nineveh as a prostitute is a degrading, shaming idea that, no, you're not a queen, you're a whore. Very different situation, very much more worse off, much more shameful, and of course, leading to the punishment that's about to experience. So as in Israel, so for Nineveh, to encourage to serve other gods is harlotry. And Nahum might well have in mind how so many Israelites were exiled, abandoned their service to Yahweh, and assimilated into the Assyrian population. But even, not even just that, the fact that Ahaz built an altar in the temple of Yahweh according to Assyrian specifications in 2 Kings chapter 16. Well, it doesn't completely cover the metaphors involved, because what of a bunch of nations serving other or different gods than before, right? When it comes to maybe not the relationship between Israel and Assyria, but Assyria and the Elamites, Babylonians, the Arameans, and so on and so forth. So even in Nahum, Nineveh's political and economic strength and force of persuasion are also being described here as harlotry and sorcery, and may well have involved literal, concrete harlotry and sorcery to some degree or another, but the metaphor is still there when it comes to all the power and everything that Nineveh is doing. Because we can understand how the Assyrians are casting a spell on the nations around them to submit to their rule, to participate in their trade and in their economic systems, which of course all redound to the benefit of Nineveh and Assyria. How is the city cosmopolitan? How has it become an economic powerhouse? Upon whose backs has this been built? Now, when governing officials wanted to punish prostitutes, it would be by public humiliation and shaming, a public stripping and exposure to shame and ridicule. And that is the illustration that this is what Yahweh is going to do to Nineveh, by the armies entering the city, plundering its wealth, executing its male citizens, and raping and enslaving its female citizens. In this way, Yahweh is going to throw filth on Nineveh and make it that spectacle. The nations would heap their own ridicule on Nineveh and Assyria, no doubt enjoying the schadenfreude of just desserts, watching it be done unto Nineveh and the Assyrians as the Assyrians had done to so many others, and would have found this very satisfying. Nahum continues, "You are no more secure than Thebes. She was located in the banks of the Nile. The waters surrounded her. Her rampart was the sea. The water was her wall. Cush and Egypt had limitless strength. Put and the Libyans were among her allies. Yet she went into captivity as an exile. Even her infants were smashed to pieces at the head of every street. They cast lots for her nobility. All her dignitaries were bound with chains. You, too, will act like drunkards. You will go into hiding. You, too, will seek refuge from the enemy. All your fortifications will be like fig trees with first ripe fruit. If they are shaken, their figs will fall into the mouth of the eater. Your warriors will be like women in your midst. The gates of your land will be wide open to your enemies. Fire will consume the bars of your gates. So Nahum 8, chapter 3, verses 8 through 13, he's turning to make a parallel between Nineveh and Assyria and their current condition and the state of Noamun, also known as Thebes and Egypt, in a previous situation. Because Thebes and Egypt have been the capital of at least most of Upper Egypt, if not the entire nation of Egypt and its empire, since about 2000 BC. Now, the Golden Days had definitely passed for Thebes by the 7th century BC, but the only ones who had ever plundered Thebes were the Egyptians themselves. For the purposes of understanding Nahum's illustrations, in 744 BC, the Kushite kings had invaded and conquered all of Egypt, and they established a 25th dynasty. Now, the 24th and 26th dynasties which surrounded it were probably from the same family, and they were of Libyan descent, which indicates why he mentions Libya. Put is believed to be what the Egyptians called Punt, which is somewhere to the south of Egypt based upon the descriptions that were given. Could be Eritrea today or Somaliland, somewhere around that area near the Horn of Africa. And throughout this historical period, Egypt enjoys a lot of protection from its geography, which is what Nahum is pointing out. The deserts of the east and west are inhospitable. The Mediterranean and the Red Seas are a major hindrance for armies. Maybe a naval expedition, but an army is going to find a hard time to attack by those means. Its main point of weaknesses are at the first cataract of the Nile to the south in Upper Egypt, and in northeast, the Sinai Peninsula. But both of them feature choke points that were easily defended. And yet, despite all these advantages, and its standing as one of the major ancient Near Eastern powers, Ashurbanipal, king of Assyria, invaded and took Thebes captive in 663 BC, which is where we've gotten the earliest possible date for Nahum, since he's mentioning it here. And by doing that, he effectively smashes Kushite power in Egypt, and it gives Egypt back over to the kings of Libyan origin, who had reigned at least over Lower Egypt for many, many years. Now, any Assyrian that's hearing what Nahum is warning is going to scoff and laugh, because after all, what happened to Thebes in Egypt? It was the Assyrians who came in and devastated and destroyed them, right? But Nahum rightly saw how Assyria would find itself beset by enemies. And perhaps what's even the most profound irony of it all, that when it all goes down in 612 BC, the only friend left for Assyria is Egypt. The Egypt that they had recently had sacked and had taken into their empire. So thus the Ninevites would stagger like drunkards and lose all confidence and courage. Their fortifications would totter and burn. And the use of the fig tree image is deliberately ironic and taunting. The Sennacherib had actually planted fig trees along the avenues of Nineveh, and he encouraged its inhabitants to eat its fruit. And so the idea that now the whole city is going to be shaken like that and others will take their fruit would be savage in its description and in its power of feeling and sentiment that it would cause. Indeed, Nahum continues, "Draw yourselves water for a siege. Strengthen your fortifications. Trample the mud and tread the clay. Make mud bricks to strengthen your walls. There the fire will consume you. The sword will cut you down. It will devour you like the young locust would. Multiply yourself like the young locust. Multiply yourself like the flying locust. Increase your merchants more than the stars of heaven. They are like the young locust which sheds its skin and flies away. Your courtiers are like locusts. Your officials are like a swarm of locusts. They encamp in the walls on a cold day, yet when the sun rises, they fly away, and no one knows where they are. Your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your officers are slumbering. Your people are scattered like sheep on the mountains, and there is no one to regather them. Your destruction is like an incurable wound. Your demise is like a fatal injury. All who hear what has happened to you will clap their hands for joy, for no one ever escaped your endless cruelty." And so the burden of Nineveh ends here with a final series of taunt in Nahum 3, verses 14 through 19. And he taunts the citizens of Assyria, who he imagines are devoting themselves to making mud brick to reinforce or repair the walls. In chapter 2, he talked about how the sluice gates would be opened and the waters would be dissolving the foundations. If we remember, there are heavy rains that cause all of the dams and sluice gates and things that the Assyrians had set up in the especially the northern parts of Nineveh, to fail. And there's this huge 2-mile hole that is in the wall. So we can imagine they're trying to make Mudbrick, trying to patch this up quickly, but it's going to make no difference. There's where the sword's going to get them. You can imagine by the wall making these mud bricks, trying to reinforce that wall. And as they're doing it, that's when the Medes and the Babylonians come in and kill the very people doing this very thing. And they would, or they were burned to death there by the burning that would also take place. And they would all be devoured like when the locusts devour green plants. Nahum continues that locust imagery. Locusts are a very powerful force in the ancient world. Locusts are grasshoppers, and individually they're not too exciting, not too difficult, but when they come together in great swarms, they turn into locusts, and they will come through, and you have a wonderful green lush field of looking like it's going to be a great harvest, and then that cloud comes, and then a day or two later, there's absolutely nothing green left, and you are now looking at starvation. And in this way, he's describing the merchants of Nineveh, its courtiers and officials. But this time, it's not kind of how they're swarming here to devour and take over as much as looking at them as they fly away, right? In the morning, you got the dew, you got kind of cool places. The insects aren't able to, you know, fly away, but as it warms up, they're able to fly away. And that's exactly what Nahum is imagining, that these merchants and these officials and these courtiers are just going to fly away. They're going to run. The merchants are there to make money. When there's money to be made in Nineveh, they'll be there. When Nineveh's threatened, the merchants are going to run. The courtiers and officials will prove less than loyal. They're going to flee to seek their own advantage because they can. They have the ability to leave, so they're going to. Just like those locusts, when there's nothing left to consume and devour, they're going to fly away. And so it will be for all of those who opportunistically took advantage of Nineveh, but now are going to flee for their own safety. And then Nahum taunts the king of Assyria himself. The shepherds of the king, his deputies among the nobility, are sleeping, probably fat and complacent. They're not perceiving any danger. The people were scattered, and none would gather them and prepare them for that effective battle. It is as if Syria has been given a mortal wound, and is in its death throes, but does not seem to know it. Perhaps this is an indication that Nahum is in that period of time where there's some competition between possible followers of Ashurbanipal, which is what's going to happen in the period from 631 to 612. There's some internal divisions going on, and it's all coming at the wrong time. So you have all these individuals pursuing their own individual gain, often at the expense of the whole, and it's going to all blow up in their faces. That Assyria has been mortally wounded, but doesn't even perceive it. And it's just a sad situation for them. But that final taunt imagines how everybody else is going to react. That they will clap and be happy. They are going to enjoy that schadenfreude, because everyone had experienced the cruelty of Assyria, and none would shed a tear at its fall or collapse. And this is the burden of Nineveh and Assyria, which Nahum has borne. So what will we say about these things? Nahum is continuing many of the same themes here in chapter 3 as he did in chapter 2, imagining the devastation that's going to come upon Nineveh, taunting the Assyrians about their imminent degradation, humiliation, imagining how everyone else would celebrate and enjoy the schadenfreude of Assyria receiving its just deserts. And we could only imagine how Nahum's comparison with Thebes and Egypt would have been derided and mocked, but would ultimately prove galling and humiliating for Nineveh and Assyria, because they had been the ones who thus humiliated Thebes and Egypt, but in time would find themselves likewise humiliated. And that's an important warning against hubris for any nation, for no matter how strong one imagines one is at any given moment, humiliation might only be a generation away. But perhaps the ultimate irony of this all is how Nineveh, Assyria, even Nahum himself get memory hold, and mostly forgotten. The stories are remembered in history. Yes, absolutely. We have some Greek reports of it. We have these reports in the Hebrew Bible. But much less is made of them, much less about themselves or the prophetic oracles against them than is made against, for instance, Babylon or Persia. In fact, we normally think of a lot of the things we've talked about in terms of, you know, attacking the enemies of the people of God who attacked them. We think more Babylon. When the Greeks are talking about the ancient Near Eastern Empire, they're talking mostly about Persia. And what's interesting is that all future empires in the Western Eurasian world would build upon and further develop what Assyria had established. But who knows of it? There's a common trend right now where women are astonished just how much men think of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire has captured our imagination. But the Roman Empire, what they learned, how they built it, was founded upon things that go ultimately back to the Neo-Assyrian Empire. But who sits and thinks about the Neo-Assyrian Empire? Very, very few people. And that's just part of the savage irony of it all, isn't it? That no one could have thought about much else in the days of Nahum. And now we don't think about it at all. An ironic fulfillment of everything Nahum prophesied. But in Nahum chapter 3, verses 4 through 7, we find Nahum's significant contribution that's going to be adapted and developed throughout the rest of Scripture. Pagan oppressive city as the wanton prostitute. And this is a contribution that's tinged with irony itself, because even when you think of the wanton prostitute, pagan oppressor, the mind's going to immediately go to whore Babylon. But it is that Nahum is the one who uses that illustration first about Nineveh. And was that something that even was on your radar before we spoke of it here? Even Nahum's main contribution has been memory hold. Now, the imagery starts with Nahum for good reason, though, because Nineveh is the first truly cosmopolitan, wealthy center of empire. Now, this is not trying to say that Memphis and Thebes and Egypt, or Ur and Akkad and Babylon and southern Mesopotamia and Tyre and maybe Damascus and the Levant were somehow insignificant. No, they are prosperous cities, they're trading hubs, and they were centers of power in previous generations. But none of them created what the Assyrians did, an empire over which the Assyrians maintained their own rulers over various lands and a population which they exiled and moved around. And Nineveh in 650 BC would have been filled not just with Assyrians, but also Arameans, at least formally Luwian-speaking, quote-unquote Hittites, Israelites, Judahites, Babylonians, Egyptians, Elamites, Urartians, and others who were compelled to live there by exile or slavery, or who gravitated toward the city because of its economic might and power. And the Assyrians would have worked diligently to incorporate and assimilate these populations into their city and empire so as to make them more Assyrian than whatever they were in their place of origin. And they projected their power throughout the ancient Near Eastern world, and they leveraged that economic power, sorry, the power and influence to gain great economic wealth, and power and standing, even if that is only something they are receiving through fear, the fear of the Assyrian army. Now, how would the Assyrians have seen their city according to the way that they looked at it? Well, a queen bedecked with jewels sitting on her throne in Tigris and Khosa rivers, empress of the world. But how did Yahweh describe the city? A wanton prostitute, seducing and enchanting the nations with her harlotry and sorcery. We've not made much of how the illustration involves women, an often oppressed and exploited group, and those who are seen in the least flattering light. We've not talked much about the actual profession of prostitution. Because the force and power of the illustration is not trying to degrade women as much as to do the comparison and contrast between types of women. Because one might give honor to a queen, but a prostitute in society is only good for exposing, degrading, humiliating, and shaming. Now, we might say, yes, we should in fact be exposing, degrading, humiliating, shaming the Johns, and that's certainly an argument to be had. But for the purposes here of the metaphor, it's about what different type of women have coming to them based upon their behavior. And Yahweh thus is going to devastate, destroy, and humiliate Nineveh and Assyria because she is not some kind of wonderful queen. She is a prostitute. She is wanton in what she has been doing. Now, after Nineveh falls, who's going to take up her mantle? Who's going to be like Nineveh? Well, Babylon would then become the great cosmopolitan city, also built on exile and enslavement. Situation of Jerusalem and Judah. Now, the prophets would not directly speak of Babylon as a prostitute, which is very interesting because of later developments. But they did imagine the nations as having drunk from Babylon's cup, and how virgin Babylon would be stripped and exposed in Jeremiah 51, verse 7, and Isaiah 47, verse 1, respectively. It would be God in Christ who would put these illustrations together, Nineveh the prostitute, and degraded Babylon in the dust in Revelation 17 and 18, creating Babylon the Great, the mother of whoredom and detestable things on earth, imagined as a woman on the beast, dressed in finery, bedecked in jewels, drunk on the blood of the saints. Now, in Revelation, Babylon is code for Rome, the current pagan oppressive power dominating the whole world, which Peter also uses in a cipher in 1 Peter 5 and verse 13. Now, what John sees brings together condemnations in the Old Testament of Babylon, Nineveh, and Tyre, descriptions of prostitution, sorcery, the leverage of political and economic power to induce compliance from the nations, and above all, the oppression and degradation of the people of God. But what connects Nineveh, Babylon, and Rome? Well, these are cosmopolitan centers of great political and economic power who, in their heyday, imagine themselves to be queen over the whole earth. And yet, all of them, in time and in turn, would be humbled. Every powerful nation imagines itself as an honorable queen, properly honored with jewels and the scepter of rule. Yet all of them prove to be the prostitute, seducing the nations with harlotry and sorcery. And thus, let us not be deceived by the propaganda of the nations. May we not find ourselves entwined with the most recent whore Babylon, but be found as part of the unblemished bride of the Lamb, maintain life in Him. Thus we have seen and considered the burden of Nineveh, which was given to Nahum. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear about them. Please let us know. Continue our conversation. Subscribe just where you found us. I'm Ethan. Work with the Venice Church of Christ. We are Christians in a non-denominational church in Los Angeles, and we'd love to be of encouragement and service to you. If we can pray for you, be answer any questions, or be there for you, you'd like to come meet with us, please let us know. You can find us online at venicechurchofchrist.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, Twitter, YouTube. And if there's anything we can do, please let us know. Please find us there. And may the Lord bless and keep you until we're able to meet again.